Let's call the meeting to order. It is 1:47 on February 27th, 2007. This is the Senate Judiciary Committee. We've come to order. Let the record reflect that Senator McGuire is here, Senator Huggins is here, Senator Terrio is here, and we've been joined by Representative Lindsey Holmes, who will not be able to participate in the House hearing on this subject this coming Friday, and so we've extended her the invitation to please join us, and we welcome you, Representative Holmes. The only thing on our calendar, Senator Wilkowski is next door presenting a bill. We expect him to join us soon. The only thing on our calendar today is the confirmation hearing for Talis Kohlberg, and I just want to put a couple things on the record before we get started. Of the confirmations that we consider, I judge this to be among the most important. 44 states elect their attorney general, but Alaska does not. We have a better system, I believe, but the confirmation process is a vital part of that system. It is necessary that we legislators uphold our gatekeeper function in order for the system to work. Therefore, you appear before us, the people's representatives, to give us the opportunity to make a reasoned judgment about your qualifications. With respect to those qualifications, I should put on the record that I've been contacted by email, by telephone, and in person by individuals who know you both personally and professionally. The comments that I have received have been, by a large majority, positive. To the extent that a clear picture emerges from those comments, you are well-respected and liked in your community, and the dominant quality that comes through about you is your thoughtfulness. Last Friday, I sent you a list of questions that I'd like you to answer today. Those questions have been distributed to the other members of the committee. I'm sure they have questions of their own. It's my hope that we can get through the questions I've given you in about 30 to 45 minutes so that there is plenty of time for each of the members to pursue their own areas of interest with you. You may see me checking my watch from time to time. With that, I'll turn to you. Please feel at ease. I want this to be a dialogue between you and the members of the committee. If you have a short introductory statement, we'd be pleased to hear it. General Kohlberg.
Thank you, Chairman French, and the Senators and Representative Holmes for this opportunity to introduce myself. I appreciate, Senator French, that you offered to provide questions in advance, and to the extent there are other people's questions, I appreciate that as well. I briefly contemplated trying to be expeditious in sending someone in my stead to answer them in advance and maybe shortening the hearing. I figured you wanted to hear from me. I'd like to just introduce myself, and Representative Ramirez had repeatedly in the hallways and elsewhere told me he wanted to hear me talk, and so I'll briefly talk about myself and try to introduce my background to you. I was born in Alaska. I've had experiences in my life living in urban areas, Anchorage, rural areas, what I consider Palmer and Bush areas. I spent fourth and fifth grade in Angoon on Admiralty Island when my father was the principal of the elementary school. So unlike many people who are on the rail belt of Alaska, I've actually not only been in other parts of Alaska, but actually lived there for extended periods of time. I know what it means when people talk about hauling water. I know what it means to see a bucket brigade in action. I know what it means when someone has problems and there's no local law enforcement readily available to help people. And overall, it's been a wide variety of experiences in my 48 years in Alaska, where I've experienced many different lifestyles, and I've come to appreciate the way people live differently in different parts of our state. I basically graduated from Palmer High School in 1976. I was a pretty good kid. I was selected as one of two Alaskan senior students to be representative of the state at the National Youth Science Camp. I was representative of one of two students statewide to be representing the state at the Bicentennial Seniors in Washington, D.C. And I was an intern for Senator Stevens when I graduated from high school. I also learned early on that the confusion about the gender of my name may have benefited me, because when I received my acceptance as an intern for Senator Stevens, it was addressed to Ms. Talis Kohlberg. And so many years of receiving letters like that and being somewhat embarrassed as a young man may have had its advantages in the long run.
If I can just interrupt you, just while we're on the subject of your first name, there's something I think particularly endearing about anything that rhymes with Hollis.
Oh, I've thought of that many times, Senator, and I'm glad that I was hesitant to suggest that we had more common ground than not.
But do you speak French?
No, but does the senator?
Neither do I.
I did take French, but I don't speak French. I attended Pacific Lutheran University in Tacoma, Washington. I graduated in 3 years. My major was Oriental History. I went on to Pepperdine University School of Law in Malibu, California. In answer to some of the questions, briefly, I was not on Law Review at no particular distinction in terms of honors, but I was in moot court to the extent that it was required of the classes, and I did help with legal aid for poor people and doing taxes in particular. After law school, I went to work for a small firm in Wasilla, Kopp, Rudin, and Heffern. That was the most general practice I've ever had as an attorney. There was my only real experience with any kind of trial work. I was not the lead attorney. I was a participant with Mr. Coprude on a couple trials, and we did a variety of things, including appellate work. My focus of practice became much more focused in 1985. In October of 1985, I was hired by the Travelers Insurance Company, and I basically was their representative in workers' compensation cases, became staff counsel, and ran their property casualty office in Anchorage. And briefly, for about a year and a half, I was brought down to the Seattle staff counsel office. And for a time, the expansion of my activities included other types of property casualty defense work for basically institutional clients. I returned to my hometown, Palmer, and I consider Palmer my hometown because that's where my family has continuously gravitated back to. My grandparents moved there in 1949. My father graduated from high school in Palmer in 1952. And I have had family connections there ever since, even though we've lived in other places. When I returned to Palmer, I established a practice of my own office, and that's where I've been for the last 15 years in downtown Palmer. I've continued to focus on workers' compensation, the big difference being I've shifted from representing institutional clients to representing individuals, injured workers. For a brief time, I did some divorce work, but basically my practice had been administrative law. So in answer to one of the other questions, are there any Supreme Court cases or Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals cases associated with me? No. My practice has been basically administrative in front of the Workers' Comp Board for most of those last 15 years. I have assisted people with other matters, small business matters, property transactions, wills and trusts, and probate. But I'd have to say that the main distinction between what I've done in the last 15 years and the first 7 years was basically I have been representing individual Alaskans and their day-to-day needs. I understand people's concerns. About 2,000 of them have been my clients in that time period, about how slow the system is in terms of getting justice, how expensive it is, their concerns about being billed for it. And unlike an institutional client, they have real reservations about even going to a lawyer, which sometimes hurts their cause because it becomes more and more apparent as time goes on in some cases that early on might have been better. So people have been my clients on an individual basis, which has been a tremendously rewarding experience personally, in that people have become much more something I can relate to than the institutional side, which I'd represented for the first 7 years of practicing law. In addition to representing individuals, I have also been involved in the community in different ways. I've worked for the University of Alaska Anchorage Mat-Su campus for 15 years as an adjunct faculty member, and I've taught between 2 and 3 courses each semester for most of those last 15 years. The courses I tend to teach are Introductions to Western Civilization 1 and 2 and Eastern Civilization 1 and 2. And in the course of that time period, I've had about 1,500 students, and so I know what people are trying to do when they go to school locally and what their aims are. I've written letters of reference for students and tried to work with them and make their college career more rewarding. And in 1999, Chancellor Gorsuch gave me an award for outstanding teaching for what I'd been doing at the Mat-Su campus. In addition to that, I've been involved in local government. I'm not unfamiliar with the needs of local communities. I was elected twice to the Mat-Su Borough Assembly. My district included about 10,000 constituents. It is now really eclipsing Fairbanks as the second most populated part of the state. And in the course of representing that district, I was elected twice by substantial margins. I think I know how to work with people, and I know how to address their needs and their concerns as an elected official. And I know what you go through when you go through for an election, putting your name on the line for approval or disapproval by the people that you represent. So I think I not only have an understanding of the municipal governments in this state, but how they work and how to address some of their needs. In addition to that, I've also been involved in pursuing my own passion, which is history, and I've been working as a graduate student with the University of Alaska Fairbanks Northern Studies program. I've been involved in the PhD program, and I'm in the dissertation stage of that program. And so in terms of any kind of publications I'm associated with, nothing formal other than I've been preparing text for my classes through Penguin Publishing of assembling classic writings, and I've also, as a graduate student, actually had the opportunity to write research papers, which under the circumstances today are becoming more and more relevant to what I would be doing as Attorney General, because I've been writing papers and looking into matters such as circumpolar health issues associated with not only Alaska but all the northern regions, issues of comparative histories of northern areas between Quebec, Scandinavia, Alaska, the Soviet Union, and trying to address on focused matters in terms of comprehensive papers, a survey of Alaska history, survey of Alaska territorial politics, and a survey of the origins of Native and non-Native affairs in Alaska. So all those things could actually have a useful benefit to the job itself, which before were really more of a hobby that I was pursuing to try to complete the PhD program. I have And during that course of that program, Dr. Judy Kleinfeld nominated me for, and I received a membership in the Phi Kappa Phi academic fraternity for those studies. In sum, while I was introduced to this state by the largest daily newspaper as an outsider, the only way I think that really applies to me in my circumstances is that I may be an outsider to certain circles in the largest urban area, in that they don't know who I was, but certainly in terms of comparing me to my predecessors, and I've read Steve Haycock's book about attorneys general, and I just made a graph of things, I would certainly point out for all it's worth that at 48, I'm amongst the three oldest people ever appointed to be attorney general in this state. I've practiced law 23 years longer than all but three of my predecessors when they were appointed as attorney general of this state. And I have been involved in not only practicing law successfully for 23 years in this state, but teaching in our university for 15 years, participating in our local government for 6 years, and participating as a student in our university for the past 4 years. And while it is true that I was not a well-known lawyer statewide before this happened, that is certainly, I think, arguably true of many of my predecessors before they were appointed Attorney General. And I guess what I would conclude is that I think that this is a job where I have an interest in what's happening in this state. I've been involved in this state all my life, and I would look forward for the opportunity to try to make what I've learned and worked on useful to achieving the ends of our governor. And that would be my introductory statement, Senator French. And I know you had questions, and I guess that would leave it about question number three, if you want to.
I think that's right. Go ahead, and if you would, just we'll begin to work through those questions proceed from there, and any follow-up on the introductory comments by Mr. Colbert. Please proceed.
What was the second, third question? Was it the ones about favorite justice?
Your favorite U.S. Supreme Court justice.
Favorite U.S. Supreme Court justice. This is something I actually hadn't focused on before, but one of the things I'd say is it kind of comes down to a tie, in my view, in terms of who I think were the two that would have meant the most to me. If you look at John Jay and being the first, I guess there's some value to that. And the next two were fairly short. Rutledge and Ellsworth, I think, were the very briefly Chief Justice. Then you get into Marshall, and Marshall certainly is the one who establishes the idea that the power of the Supreme Court is the final say on matters, and that there should be some recognition of deference to the final word on court jurisdiction being the end of the matter. I think Justice Taney was perhaps forever tarred by the Dred Scott decision, but when you look through his long tenure, I think you can see that he had a lot of reaffirmation of what Marshall had established, because it was only under his tenure that the Marshall of Madison, Marbury versus Madison, was reaffirmed, and it was almost a half a century after it was first put out there. But when it gets down to skipping all over the several fairly short-term justices until you get to Charles Evans Hughes, I think Hughes would be someone that I would say would be one of my favorites. And I think it's because he straddled a very difficult time in our history, because it's really the New Deal that came into play during his tenure, even though he was a Hoover judge. And he was one of the people who was uniformly knocking down New Deal legislation, but what he exhibited was, I think, a willingness to be open-minded about things, and he was one of the switch in time to save nine that avoided Franklin Roosevelt's effort to try to add six judges to get his way. And it wasn't just because it was expedient to do so. I think there's a lot in his background that would suggest that he was conservative, which I would consider myself to be someone who is partial to conservatives, but at the same time, willingness to be open. He was considered progressive on race matters for the times that he lived in, and so I would see him as a nice combination of conservative and progressive. The other Chief Justice who I have some admiration for, and I think it's because of his appreciation for history as well as the law, was Justice Rehnquist. And to a large degree, what I know of Chief Justices are because of the two books he wrote. One was about the Supreme Court itself, and the other one's called Grand Inquests, which he basically outlined the history of different judicial crises in the course of our country and how people handled them, and basically pointed out, well, some people may have been perceived one way or the other. There was often more to them than what appeared at the moment to be the decision being the way they were defined, as opposed to a more comprehensive picture of their overall outlook. So in answer to that question, I'd consider personally a tie between Hughes and Rehnquist in terms of who I would favor.
And how about U.S. President?
That gets to be more problematic for me. I definitely have two favorites. A lot of them have virtues that I think are worthy of noting. You know, George Washington, it gets so easy to say he's the first, but, you know, I think Byron had a very wonderful poem about Washington, first, the last, the best, the Cincinnatus of the West. And when he basically was doing was comparing him to Napoleon and saying, you know, who before in history had ever had total power and given it up willingly? And Napoleon didn't, but Washington didn't. Who did that before? And that was not an easy thing to do, but that becomes the pattern that we've come to respect over time. And, you know, John Adams was, you know, someone who really did a lot to continue that tradition. And Jefferson was someone, you know, who obviously had a kind of effervescent brilliance, but you can see some nasty streaks in the things that he said about other people while he was alive. But and then, you know, all those first six after that, Madison, Monroe, following were accomplished people, and I'd argue that John Quincy Adams was perhaps the best prepared man ever to be president, just because he knew the first six personally, and they kind of shepherded him through life before he got to be president himself. But and then Andrew Jackson, I don't think you could ever say that there was someone who did more to make people feel that the American democracy was really the common person's democracy, because he really wasn't the aristocrat. He was someone who came to represent, this is our government to all the people. And then the next few get kind of eclipsed because they're sandwiched between Jackson and Lincoln. And, you know, Martin Van Buren, William Henry Harrison, John Tyler, James Knox Polk, Zachary Taylor, Miller Fillmore, Franklin Pearson, James Buchanan. With the exception of Harrison, they all contributed to stability of the Republic. Harrison only lasted about a month, so you can't say much about his legacy one way or the other. And then Lincoln would be one of my two favorites. And I think it's because he has kind of like Leonardo da Vinci's kind of the inherent natural giftedness, but even though he lacked the formal education, he kind of transcended that, and his almost biblical language that he puts together some of those incredible phrases. You often wonder what would have happened with his legacy had there not been a war, and you have to think that he just had the gift to command attention and ideas that he would probably have eclipsed people in any event. And then his successors kind of fall in the same category as his predecessors. They just kind of get eclipsed by him in time. I think Andrew Johnson is underestimated. The man put a tremendous amount of his personal life on the line for basically joining the North when everyone he knew was on the other side. And you go through Grant, Harris, Rutherford B. Hayes, Garfield, Arthur, Grover Cleveland twice, Benjamin Harrison, and McKinley. They all are like the others that kind of get shadowed by Theodore Roosevelt. But and Roosevelt, just, you know, incredible energy. But again, Woodrow Wilson, a very thoughtful person, I think, contributed a lot, not appreciated in his own lifetime. And then you get into more recent times and people get to be more judgmental about things. But I think Herbert Hoover, like Jimmy Carter, basically was someone who, with an engineering background and very thoughtfulness, just kind of wasn't in the right element for his training. But I would say my other favorite is Ronald Reagan. And Ronald Reagan, to me, has always been an inspiration, not just because I think he had a gift for communicating his ideas in a thoughtful and pleasant way, but because I'm basically half Latvian, and my great-grandparents died in a concentration camp in the Yenisei River in Siberia. And so for an Eastern European, my mother being a refugee, it was always something we wanted to see, was a president who seemed to understand what communism was all about. And Ronald Reagan was always able to communicate his views on that, I thought, very effectively and ultimately in a very meaningful way. So my two presidents would be Lincoln and Reagan.
Thank you. Let's turn to matters more more focused on the job you're about to assume. What do you see as the primary mission of the Attorney General?
Well, primary mission, as you kind of outlined, and I would have thought it was 43 when you said it was 44 states elect their attorney generals. Regardless, I think one of the problems that comes from the appointed side of it is that you look at the statute that we have that governs what the attorney general is supposed to do, and you can start to see where there can be contentiousness. I'm the attorney general that represents the state of Alaska, the governor, elected officials, advises the legislature. And in a political context, you can see where that becomes something of a problem at times, where you would wonder how it would be necessarily improved by an elected figure who had his own political agenda to pursue. But it is ultimately the proper answer seems to be is the mission of the Attorney General is to serve the best needs of the people of the state of Alaska and advise the governor accordingly. And where that mission becomes difficult is when you decide how to pursue that. And ultimately, I think the safest course of action really has to be to look for the correct answer to questions as opposed to what might be the popular answer. And that, I think, may account for why, if you look through the numbers of attorney generals in the history of our state and the numbers of governors, it's about 2-1. In fact, sadly, attorney general's tenure in this state is fairly short. It's about 1.6 years to the average if you take out the two longest serving tenures of Mr. Botello and Mr. Gorsuch. And so there tends to be a higher turnover for attorneys general, and it may have to do in part with the tension that comes from trying to serve so many masters.
This may be an opportunity for questions from members of the committee while we're on this subject. Members of the committee, Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. You mentioned that, if I heard you correctly, you feel that the task of the Attorney General is to serve the best interests of the people. And I think sometimes there seems to be conflicts between what's in the best interest of the people, and at least I can imagine a conflict, and what the governor wants to do. And how do you reconcile that if you're asked to do something that you don't feel is in the best interest of the people?
Well, I think perhaps just by example, I think we've had an extraordinarily busy time for a new administration, and I think the most recent contentious issue, which shows how the issue can arise, is regarding a Board of Regents and appointment that has now raised a lot of attention. Clearly, the governor has sent a letter asking a regent to resign. That would indicate the governor would be looking for a way to bring this to a conclusion. Working with my staff, our advice is basically we need to be cautious about that. If you were looking for a result-driven conclusion, it would be naturally to come closer to just terminating the discussion rather than following a course of action which might take more time and not be as instant a result. And so I think in that case is an example of trying to do the right thing, and I think the governor is appreciative of that. And while there may have been certainly a desire for the governor to bring things to an end sooner, that's where we are.
Follow-up question.
Yeah, thank you. Since you brought up the topic of the removal of an Alaska regent, I have the opinion that was issued, and I did have a question on that. And the question that was asked in that opinion was, essentially, does the governor have the power to remove a University of Alaska regent without cause? And I guess the question that comes to me and other people that I've spoken with is, well, isn't there cause? If someone has 92 indictments, and if someone has allegedly misused the state seal, and if someone has missed a number of meetings, doesn't that give the governor cause to remove that person?
I think that it's a very basic and simple answer that I'd have to give you, Senator, and that is that guilty is not happened until he was proven innocent. Until proven guilty is the premise of the system, and the indictment is not a finding, and that's the cause is how we're interpreting proven guilty.
Senator Terrio was next, then McGuire.
Hey, well, on that topic, it's true there's no proof on the federal indictments, but I would think that the state action would perhaps, well, would be on separate issues, the misuse of the university seal for personal gain and the lack of participation or fulfillment of the function. So I don't think there's a suggestion that we prejudge or convict on federal charges. That's up to the federal government to do. But what about the separate standards and a lower standard that the state entity could do?
Again, thank you, Senator Terrio.
Both the governor and potentially the legislature.
Yeah, I think there would be room for creating a mechanism for having a hearing process which would establish those things, but to just act without going through something like that, I think, would be the question that was being answered.
Follow up, please.
And is part of the problem that process that is perhaps suggested or open to interpretation, whether it's allowed under the Constitution, as far as powers for the governor, it's unclear. And not only unclear in the Constitution, it's not clarified in the statutes versus the clear authority of the legislature through an impeachment action, which we do have precedent on. So was part of your advice to the governor that the potential power of the governor is unclear? It's likely to be opposed by the university itself. And so rather than weigh into that quagmire, if it can be avoided, it should be.
I think that's a fair assessment.
Thank you.
Senator McGuire.
On that point, and not to belabor it, but I think it gives a nice example of how you might go about continuing to do the job that you do. You made the statement that you thought your job was to serve the public, and in this case, to bring an issue like this that's highly contentious to closure as quickly as possible, because it would be in the public's best interest. And unfortunately, I happen to disagree with your legal opinion, and do believe that, in fact, the legal opinion that we received from Jack Chenoweth, my personal opinion, is that the governor, having handled this, would have been in the public's best interest, and it would have been, I think, the more appropriate legal action. That's my own personal opinion. That said, and more of a commentary, my question for you is, what is the process by which you went through to make that decision? And I'm always curious, because we don't have an elected attorney general, but yet you are that direct line to the public, and that is your first job above the governor. What was the process you went through in determining that opinion? Do you have conversations with the governor herself? And if you did in this case, would you consider them in the future, or would you consider your job to be that of an independent attorney analyzing situations based on their merit and how they reflect, the ramifications reflect on the public as opposed to the governor herself in the future?
If the question is, did the governor give me a pre-instruction of where the answer was to be, the answer is no. The way the decision was arrived at was with the staff that's most familiar with that area of the law, and I think Senator Wilkowski actually probably has the opinion there that shows the actual members who participated and helped drafting that. And in fact, they relied on previous opinions that had been worked on similar issues in the past that were drawn together to reach those conclusions. That's the process, working with the staff that's familiar with the area, which is what happens normally in the time I've been involved. When we are presented with a question, the deputy that's in the appropriate division would be asked to bring forward whoever is most familiar with that area, and then we have discussions, and we try to put together an opinion and then deliver it.
Follow up.
And just a brief follow up. I really appreciated your opening remarks, and think a lot of you. I don't consider you to be an outsider, and also disagree with that analysis. I think it's exciting to see somebody come into the process that isn't a repeat player, if you will. You certainly have the qualifications, so by no means I don't intend my questions to be confrontational. The reason that I asked them is that we had a situation a couple of years ago while I was serving in office where we had another attorney general who appeared at moments in time to be serving at the right hand of the governor in place at that time, and almost as if he was an extension at some points in time. Certainly we know that led to an ethics issue about what involvement he should or should not have had in certain issues. And the reason I asked what process you went through is that I'd just like an idea about how you view your job and how you view that distinction between your relationship with the public and your relationship with the governor. It is delicate, I recognize it, but I think it's important for the public to understand, in light of past behavior that's occurred, that might call that into question.
Sure. And if I could just follow up to Senator McGuire, just it may reassure you to a certain degree, and maybe not, to know that even though the governor and I are both from the same borough, and there tends to be a sense that she just picks someone from the same town, we're actually from different towns, which are traditionally rivals. And I did not know the governor socially before this happened. She would have known me from me being on the assembly while she was mayor, but they were different bodies. And I have not been a personal advisor or lawyer for the governor before. And I would have to say that my assessment of why I'm here is because she knows enough about me to feel she can trust me, and I hope that's well placed. But it's not because I have been someone who's been active in her political activities or campaigns before. And while that may seem somewhat not credible to people outside the Valley, there's 80,000 people in the Valley. It's not a small area anymore. Thank you.
Very last question.
Sounds like one more follow-up. Yes.
If the governor were to ask you to perform a task such as negotiate a contract deal with a resource development company that you felt were outside the scope of acting as the Attorney General for the state of Alaska, do you feel comfortable with the ability to say no to that?
Well, without trying to focus on that particular question, I haven't thought about a resource development company. If the governor asked me to do something that I did not feel comfortable with, I would feel like I have the ability to say no.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. Getting back to the University of Regent issue, knowing what you know now, knowing that there is at least allegation of misuse of the seal, that there is an allegation of missed meetings, does that rise to the level of just cause that would give the governor the ability to dismiss that regent?
We don't have a hearing process in place to make such assessments right now. If I mean, I think it could be created. I think you could. I mean, clearly there are issues there that look, by just the number, to be overwhelmingly conclusive as to where it's going. But it, again, the definition of cause, I don't think is just preponderance of allegations.
I'll just say for myself, I think there has to be some definition that's short of a guilty verdict at trial. I think we frequently find ourselves, and this is not just in this situation but in others, where we have an official charged with a crime, and many folks take the position that we just have to wait until the legal system sort of gets to the very end of its process. And I'm not always of that view. It's my view that there are times when the allegation is strong, the evidence is strong, that irrespective of a guilt or innocent verdict, for the good of the state and for the clean image of the state has to take action and protect itself against that cloud. And in my view, this is one of those instances. I think you're sensing that the panel views this differently than you do. I don't want to belabor it, but I felt like I had to speak up there.
I've definitely got that sense, sir.
Thank you. And Senator Huggins on that same point.
Yeah, I'm on this panel, and don't lump me into that as an individual.
I beg your pardon.
Yeah. And if I might.
Please.
You know, I probably know Talis about as much as Sarah does, which is not very much. But, you know, I would say the first thing, and I'm proud to have Talis as a neighbor. We live in different towns. I actually live on the other side of the other town in the valley. But, you know, I think that he said an operative word, which I think is very important to us, and sometimes you have to search hard in some people to find. It's called trust. I would expand that to honesty. I would expand that to integrity. And as I look across in the attribute I like the most about Talis is that I don't see a lot of lawyer in him. He has lawyerly capabilities, but he's a good man.
Thank you, Senator Huggins. Senator Terrio.
Thank you. Back to the overall issue of operating the Department of Law, certainly with an entity as big and complex as the state of Alaska, you've got civil cases, you've got oil and gas cases, you've got criminal cases. The thought that you're going to have an attorney general that embodies, is an expert on all those things, I think is incorrect. And sometimes I think that the general public thinks, well, the attorney general is going to be in court every day, you know, prosecuting these different cases, which is, of course, not true. So I'm wondering if you can give us an idea of your view of how you will manage, you know, the State of Alaska Inc. and all the things that happen in that, and assure that you have expertise that you can count on if, in fact, things get to the point that needs to be bumped up to you, and then I would hope that you would have them, if it warrants you weighing in on a decision, they'd brief you, make their arguments. I'm sure there'd be perhaps difference of opinion, and you'd give some direction. But on a day-to-day basis, you're not going to be in court arguing all these cases for the state.
You're quite right, Senator, and frankly, I think you're probably correct that a lot of people have a different image of what the Attorney General does, and as you all on this panel would know, there's a multitude of issues every day that changes very quickly, and there's a reason why there's a line of people standing behind me or sitting behind me today. They are the front line of the top of the pyramid where questions come to me every morning, every day, and I basically spend a good part of the day delegating out things to get an answer that comes back to me, and then I get to see the things that are most most concerned to the people who are asking the questions on a day-to-day basis. Do I or anyone else have the physical time to become the attorney in a given matter in all these cases? No, that's not possible. And again, I guess one of the most revealing things was reading Steve Haycock's books about my predecessors and just noting that not only did many of them have less time as lawyers before they were appointed, someone was as few as 4 years as a lawyer before they were appointed. I don't know that there's an instance of anyone ever claiming or trying to claim they would be the expert on all the different fields. The civil division has 13 subcategories that are specializing in areas, and some of those areas actually routinely hire outside counsel to assist them to even more specialized areas. It's basically, from my point of view, a matter of trying to be the communication point between the Department of Law and the governor and the legislature and whoever else is seeking a department head, commissioners, issues that are at the top of their screen on a given day. But thank you for the question. I think you're correct.
This actually brings us, I think, nicely to question number 6, which is about the civil division. Tell us whether you had time to meet the section chiefs, the senior attorneys in that division, what you see as the biggest challenge facing that division, and what plans, if any, you've developed to take action.
In some ways, I've lumped both the civil and criminal division together in some regards and answer that question. The next two questions, basically, is salaries is increasingly an issue in the Department of Law, and in the immediate future, it doesn't appear to be on the radar screen for the legislature in terms of a bill that's being sponsored by anyone, but what you should all be aware of is that there is a real gap between where the Department of Law salaries are, and increasingly what parallel positions in municipalities in this state or in even other states would be for similar positions. And I think one of the questions talks about comparing 3, 5, and 10-year positions. And what's clear is that to the degree you have definite answers from, for example, boroughs, the Department of Law is lagging roughly $10,000 behind on 3- and 5-year positions and probably even further than that on 10-year positions.
Compared to a borough or a private firm?
Kenai borough. Or
the Natsu borough, another borough,
government position.
Thank you.
For private jobs, it's more problematic for me to give you any definitive answer because the variety of compensation packages varies so much from deferment practice to practice. But what it does point out is in the specialized areas especially, and I'll take because it seems to be most on the radar right now, oil and gas, is we only have 14 positions in the oil and gas, the civil division. Department, and 12 of them are filled, and 2 of them are in a state of change because of the basic lack of competitiveness for those specialized positions. And so we are in a position where if people were looking at a purely economic point of view, which would be a reasonable way for a person to look at their own situation, that state service in their specialty, once they have the experience, starts to become problematic in terms of they could make a lot more money and the attraction is there, and we do have higher turnover there. What we have not as big a problem is beginning positions in civil and criminal division. People like that experience. They like that opportunity to get a start. It's the gap between the 5-year employee and the 20-year employee that we have a disproportionate number of people leaving compared to other, for example, attorney general's offices in other states where you would have a higher percentage of people staying on to become career employees, which leads to the secondary issue, which is, what would be, I think, appropriate goal for attorney general looking at these two divisions is, in addition to salaries, mentoring people to basically carry on the job. As we approach the point where a significant number of the 20-year and older employees who are in Tier 1 are on the verge of retiring, the real question is who will replace that echelon of people that basically has been the most experienced, the most talented people, not necessarily the most talented compared to anyone else as much as they've just built up that experience that makes them very useful, when there are fewer and fewer people to train the new folks. And so what really needs to be looked at is a comprehensive review of the salary structure for both divisions. And then that, in part, will hopefully address the retention and mentoring of the mid-level attorneys and keeping people more interested in a career path rather than just a training ground through the state of Alaska. Have I met with the heads? I have not met with all the heads. I've met a lot of people. I've met people who've told me they've never met an attorney general before, which is sometimes
that's good.
And the criminal division, because it's 13 offices statewide, I can only say I've met 4 of the 13 DAs.
And which ones are those?
I met the Juneau. I consider Mr. Svobodny, he's an office of special prosecutions,
right.
And Mr. Gardner, so that'd be 2 there. And then Fairbanks, Mr. O'Brien, and then Palmer, Roman Kataliak.
Sure. Okay. Thank you. Let's go on down. I think you've addressed most of those questions, at least in enough detail for us to get an idea of where you stand. Let's skip down to number 10. This is an area of particular concern to me and I think to other members of the public. Mm-hmm. We, in this state, suffer from some of the highest sex assault and sex abuse rates in the nation. Can you tell me whether prosecutions of this crime are increasing? Are trials on these charges increasing? If you have any statistics, we'd be interested in hearing them. And more generally, and perhaps most importantly, rather than the statistics, is what plans do you have or do members of your department have to take action on this extremely important public safety issue?
Okay. Statistics are harder to get a handle on here than I had imagined when I first got your question in advance and tried to get some statistics. What I do have is the total number of reported assaults for adults and for minors. Getting the actual prosecution levels, what turned out to be a little bit harder than I imagined getting a consistent answer. What I have is a chart that shows from 1997 through 2006 a fairly comprehensive number of referrals, which basically statewide has ranged from about 289 in 1997 being the low year to 351 in 2002.
And those referrals are on charges of?
Sexual assault for adult cases.
Thank you.
And in those statistics, it's not clear that there's been an overall statewide increase. In fact, we're down somewhat from the peak back in 2002. We're at 321 last year, 323 the year before. It is a pretty steady range that would probably average out to about 320 a year. So what that suggests, at least in terms of those cases, is that there is a possibly even a slight decline if you take into account population increase in the same time period. Sexual assaults on minors is similarly, if you took 97 as a beginning point and last year as a follow-up and all the years in between, is actually down by almost a third statewide. Now, what's misleading about these statistics is it's not really taking into account the demographic divisions in the state, which points to a completely different story. Last year, and I don't have the number in front of me, but I know Mr. Svobodny had been talking to me about this about a month ago, that the city of Bethel apparently had more sexual assaults than the entire city of Anchorage. And so what is apparent from that little snapshot is that while statewide it doesn't appear to be a burgeoning problem, it may very well be an extremely serious problem disproportionate to Bush, Alaska. And the prosecution levels would suggest that in the last 10 years it's roughly averaging 75% conviction rate, if the numbers I have in front of me are correct, for adults and closer to about 80%, 82% for children prosecutions in the last 5 years. What the last 2 years statistics are not useful for, because they show considerably different numbers, may be skewed because they're taking reported cases on a year and reporting the outcome, which in some of the cases may not be resolved yet, even though they're on the total number. So I have to kind of step back 2 years, and I don't know if the last 2 years are a different statistic altogether, or they're just not completely in because they're not done with the cycle of prosecution or resolution in one form or another. What I think my answer ultimately to you would be is I think there is a very disproportionately serious problem in Bush, Alaska. And I think it kind of touches on probably the last question to a certain degree, in that we have a very, very complex set of relationships in terms of government services and prosecution, and even relating partly back to the preceding question about retention. One of the problems of retention that's slightly different from retention overall of attorneys is retention especially in Bush locations. Some places like Bethel, like Kotzebue, it is just extremely problematic to keep people there, and you basically are in a situation where we have deals where we make 2-year commitments to stay out there for people, and sometimes it goes over that. You will see in the paper, if you watch such things carefully, that there's sometimes difficulty getting people to even respond to some of the Bush positions for the attorney positions, and they might have to be re-advertised a couple times before someone will even respond to something like that. So there's a need that's disproportionate, and there's a service problem even where we have the apparatus in place and the ability to fund it, to just get someone to go out there and deal with it. What comes through also is, you know, it's really responsive at the point where it gets to us, and you know, a solution probably ultimately has to do a lot with trying to address the problem earlier on, which again is a resource issue about education about abuse, because there's a definite relationship between alcohol and drug abuse and the crimes, especially with the sexual crimes associated with the lifestyle that comes with isolation and the absence of law enforcement authority on the spot at the time, the ability to follow through with a response in a timely and effective manner. So while I can't give you an exact statistic breakdown in the Bush areas, I think there is a problem there that doesn't show up on the statewide numbers, which don't seem to be going the wrong way. In fact, statewide, you could make the argument that we're experiencing a decline in sexual assaults on both adults and minors, if the numbers I have are right, over the last 10-year period.
Follow up on that topic. Thank you. Question 11 is, last year the legislature provided funding for 6 new Superior Court judges. Will there be an increase in either civil or criminal attorneys in response to those new judges? We've heard that, we've heard from some of the representatives from the Department of Law that they feel like they're chasing judges. They're having to fill empty courtrooms, and they feel stressed because of those. The new judges are demanding and want to have hearings, of course, and there may not be state attorneys to fill those courtrooms. What's new on that front?
From what I can tell, that may not just be anecdotal, but it may be a reality. It appears that with those 6 new judges, it may have been merely 2 new attorneys in the Palmer office, which is targeted because it's one of the fastest growing areas of the state, and 1 criminal division office assistant in addition to those 2 attorneys. So all 6 judges aren't in that office, but it doesn't appear that there was a corresponding statewide increase in the number of attorneys to address what will increasingly be more judges.
And so just so I'm clear, do you anticipate asking for more positions to compensate or to react to those new judgeships?
I'm trying to be very careful here, because I think that what's partly in the process is looking at the whole state budget overall, and I think that, like any department, I think there's a real way to be able to justify that more help would be more useful to the state overall, but I don't want to get out in front of what may very well be budget decisions that need to be looked at in the overall picture for the state's best interest there as well.
Follow up.
Well, a little bit different. Dealing with judges, do you believe we need to change the way we select and retain judges?
I'd say that's an interesting question. I have no. First of all, just for the record, I have no quarrel with any particular existing judge. What I found interesting, because actually part of the work I done, my graduate work, was a review of the selection system, which was generically called the Missouri system that we use in this state, as opposed to the elected systems or combination of systems in other states. And one of the most interesting books that I read suggested that when it gets right down to analyzing the quality of judges and their training, their background, and their effectiveness, there's very little statistically measurable difference between the type of judge selected under our system and the type of judge selected under another system. And where that would be an issue is, as you well know, on our system, the only time people really have an encounter with a judge outside the legal system is on a retention ballot. And we routinely in this state have between 30% and 40% of the people just voting no without apparently distinguishing between judges. I mean, it's pretty much across the board. And that I think stems in part from a frustration of not knowing who these people are to most people. And one of the benefits of an elected system, and I'm not advocating it, but I'm just making this observation, is that in elections people do have some reason to know something about who their judges are, unless they're in the legal system. And the downside of our system is if someone really wants to take a shot at a judge and be clever about it, they can organize like they did in the Rabinowitz campaign at the last minute. And the way our system set up makes it somewhat problematic for a judge to defend themselves on a shortened time notice, and they can actually be quite vulnerable to a concerted effort to try to remove them. From what I've read, it appears that the difference in the two systems is not all that marked. I don't see a particular reason to change it, but I can see arguments for both sides and why people would say that there are benefits to knowing something more about who your judges are. The downside being they have to raise money and develop constituencies, which makes it somewhat more problematic about their neutrality on litigation.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, you're don't advocate changing the way we select and retain judges?
No.
Okay. And then do you have kind of a general opinion of whether or not you think the Alaska Supreme Court judges are too activist, or whether do you have an opinion on that?
I don't want to get into commenting on our judges. I respect our court, and I think it would be inappropriate for me to start to I respect the fact that they're on the court and their decisions, and if I start to suggest I have strong feelings about judges or the way they are in general, I think that's inappropriate.
Well, are there any decisions that have been issued within the last, say, 10 years that you disagree with?
Probably, yeah.
Can you name us any?
I really don't think that would be a good idea for me to get into trying to create a sequence of questions that would lead it to... I have a lot of respect for the court.
Senator Terrio.
Are you going to go into the next question?
I am, yeah. Question 12 is about a controversy that raged this building last year with respect to the power of taxation, what I call the no surrender clause in the Alaska State Constitution, and the proposed contract we saw last year that, in my view, violated that that constitutional provision against the surrender of the power of taxation. It does lead to a difficult, it leads to a difficult position because the producers make a compelling argument that they need some form of tax stability. In my view, they just can't get it through our Constitution. They need a different set of laws to provide them what they seek. What's your view of this matter, and explain your rationale?
Yeah, I had a chance to read Attorney General Marcus's May 2006 opinion and some of the follow-up correspondence that went back and forth about Article 9 and Sections 1 and 4. And the idea that Section 4 would serve no purpose unless it was meant to allow for a fairly broad obligation on the part of the state, it seems to be really something that's not as certain as the memo would indicate. I mean, the cases that they seem to be relying on are from other states, Washington, Arizona being very prominent in the citations there. Say that a proposal like fiscal certainty would be possible because there'd be no other reason to have the Section 4 in there, and that you must read them because of the Alascom case, that maybe read in harmony with each other. I guess ultimately I'd say I think legislatures would always retain the right to change their view on things, and it's the federal contracts clause that I think was the crucial component of that would say, well, there'd be a remedy for the party who would feel like they had been damaged because they had detrimentally relied on this commitment. But I don't think you really could just guarantee anyone that the legislature could not be unbound by a subsequent legislature. Now, there would be public policy reasons not to do that. There would be, in the context of a contract, real damages issues I think might be a problem for someone changing their view. But it's not hard to imagine circumstances, especially over a 3 or 4 decade period, where just unanticipated, let alone anticipated, changes over that kind of time period would give a legislature pause to say, you know, I know they committed to this, and I know that you know, it's a big deal, and people have invested a lot on this, but I would think that it would, regardless of the opinion you would get, would lend itself to a real serious battle at some point, and no one could seriously say, I know what the outcome would be. I think Section 4, to say it was meant to allow a major surrender or qualification of future legislative taxation power is not as certain as Attorney General Marcus had written in there, but I can see why he got to the point where he thought he could defend it. I can't sit here and say it's absolutely wrong, but I'd say there's there is a problem there.
Follow up on that point.
Yes, in a statement in the governor's press conference today, Marty Rutherford indicated that in AGEA there will be a possible tax exemption or tax credit that is offered between the point of making FTs in an open season and the tax that's in place then compared to the potential tax that is in place when gas actually flows, and that that credit mechanism would be in place for 10 years, up to 10 years. Now, I know that we had economic advice last year from Econ One that indicated that once you get beyond 10 years, the impact on taxes really don't, shouldn't affect your decision making today, because once you get out so far into the future, the tax rate is almost immaterial to the decision you make today whether to invest or not. So, I mean, that seems to get right at this issue, whereas last year we were confronted with, you know, the potential of a 35 to 45 year lock-in on tax rates on oil and gas. What's being proposed here or will be rolled out on Friday is a tax credit or tax exemption for the difference between what the tax was and what it is when gas starts flowing for a period of time when economists can at least make the argument that the investment decision will be impacted, or it potentially can be impacted. So I'm wondering if you can, you know, having read Marcus's decision, offer us some insight into your interaction with the team and coming to that provision.
I think that, again, you have to look at that there is always going to be a question about how much you can bind a future legislature, and it's an opportunity that really, the shorter the time period, I think, the less problematic it gets to be. And 10 years, I think, is quite different than 30 or 45 years.
So you think just a fundamental, if you had to go into court to justify it, at least being able to make the case that you do impact the investment decision within this time period, but once you get past that, it's completely unsupportable?
I would not say it's completely unsupportable. I think, you know, Attorney General Marcus laid out the argument for why you could argue it's supportable. I think there's a lot of speculative aspects to it that start to diminish as the time shortens.
Okay. And have you been actively involved in the shaping of the language on this provision, or at least advice been proffered?
I have not been personally actively involved in it. Our oil and gas section has been, and in fact, they have also, like I referenced before, called upon even more specialized outside counsel to assist them.
Okay. Thank
I'm
you.
Aware of it. I've seen it. I'm being informed on it. But I am not. I have never tried to represent myself as an oil and gas specialist, and I think it would be detrimental to stay for me to pretend to be so at this point on something that's important.
Thank you.
Other follow-up on this topic. We are in the area of oil and gas. The next question is about the TAPS settlement. You filed a notice with the TAPS owners that the state may opt out of the 1985 and 1986 settlement agreements. My questions are, have the negotiations begun, and what are the financial implications of this step?
Three parts to the answer on this. First, rest assured, I did not just walk in and decide to do it without talking to someone about it and discussing what's going on here. We have taken this action because it is, we believe, in the best interest of the state there's really two things going on here. We have ongoing litigation with the FERC about what is the proper tariff. And there's a real significant difference of what the tariff should be per barrel, ranging somewhere in the neighborhood of $1.96 a barrel to $5 a barrel, and the difference between the two numbers being somewhere probably the right answer, ultimately, in answer to part of your question, amounts to theoretically up to $80 to $100 million per year in question. Mm-hmm. To not basically move to renegotiate would basically leave this on a year-by-year basis to be an ongoing battle until 2011. We believe, our department believed, that the best approach was to give notice that we would like to renegotiate, which opens up a two-year window. Have negotiations start right now? No, we're waiting for the conclusion of the FERC decision regarding the dispute about the proper tariff to come out. We expect that will be sometime in May, and there may be a process that makes it go a little bit longer than that. And at that point, when we have a decision, we would then use that as a starting point to continue discussions. It was just noticed that we planned to do that. That was the time period to open the notice.
And what is the timeline? I mean, when do we reach sort of a go or no go point, and when do we formally sort of set aside the agreement we've been working under and begin to negotiate a new agreement?
We have to do that within the next 2 years from when we gave the notice for 2009.
So it's 24 months from the date of notice, which was?
That's January 1st.
January.
December 31st.
Senator Theriault.
And the current structure stays in place until replaced. Is that right, or could there be?
I can't for sure say that. I wouldn't say that. I know that it will come to an end. Whether in the absence of an agreement, what happens next, I wouldn't want to guess on that.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. The Constitution talks about, as far as natural resources, getting the maximum benefit for Alaskans. There's been discussion about how you've defined that. What does that mean? What is your interpretation of what that means? Maximum benefit for Alaskans, as far as oil and gas resources, natural resources.
Well, I suppose that would depend on the particular resource and how it's accessibility and what it takes to get it and whether there's a desire to develop it. I mean, it's under the Gettysburg. For example, I guess to apply to the question that was just asked, we're trying to get the best tariff rate possible in this circumstance for the state to get the maximum benefit. We're not just accepting, obviously, what was put in place. We felt it was wrong. Will there ever be a compromise that might not get to the maximum on something when it might lead to a resolution? It may be appropriate to compromise in a given circumstance to get a certain result. I think it's just going to depend on the circumstance, and the question's got to be focused more. It's the best result for the people. Maybe you have a definition in mind that I could.
Well, no, just as an example, there's sometimes an issue about whether or not we, as far as royalty gas, for instance, whether or not we can take that and use that as low-cost gas for Alaskans, or whether or not we should sell that and try to get the maximum value that we can, sell it and get the maximum profit that we can for it, for the general fund. Do you have an opinion on that, for instance?
I like having that option. I think I can see where the circumstances would warrant going one way or the other. If there's a need for it, South Central Alaska and having gas, I think there's a great argument for it, since the current reserves are clearly being depleted.
If I could just stray a little bit kind of on that subject, but the South Central, there is a big issue with natural gas and the supply that we have and the increases that we've seen, 81% in the last 3 years. I know people all over Alaska pay a lot. But what do you intend to do? Do you intend to take an active role in protecting the consumers of South Central and all of Alaska through your ability to intervene in RCA cases and other types of cases to protect the consumers of Alaska?
By statute, that is an obligation for the Attorney General to look out for the consumers. And in the RCA cases, I believe we are actively engaged in that. I think on that particular issue, while I haven't focused on it, I think part of what happened there is there was a tying of the natural gas rates to Louisiana circumstance, which was unexpectedly affected by the hurricane, which has become very controversial. But I know that we have people in the Department of Law who are actively looking at ways to try to address some of those concerns related to the NSTAR, in particular, gas rates. And that is part of our job, to try to protect people from that.
Have you given any kind of thought to disallowing the use of Henry Hub or putting some sort of caps on the rates that can be charged?
I haven't personally given any thought about price caps, or I know that the Henry Hub, I think that is the Louisiana provision, is something that has obviously drawn concern. There's certainly been no policy decision on my part to establish any kind of price control per se, or to issue a directive along that line. It's more of we are concerned, and we do have people looking at it. I haven't reached a broad, I don't really know that it would be for me to make that broad a policy decision about price control litigation.
Question, an easy question about tribes and tribal sovereignty. What is the, yeah, this is always a contentious area. It's an always an area. It's a complex area, but I think it's important to raise it here today. What will be your department's approach to the issues of tribes and tribal sovereignty in Alaska? What's your view of this topic?
I think it is perhaps the most complicated topic that persistently has stayed with us, and I try to look at it, the long range of things about, you know, why is it that way here? Every state that has Native American relationships has some degree of difficulty. We seem to have a disproportionate amount, and I think historically it comes from our geography, our isolation, and basically a federal neglect, whether intentional or not. You know, we had Native American people in this state that didn't probably realize or know that they were claimed to being ruled by either Russians or Americans for much of the early American period, just because there was not a lot of contact in the northern and interior regions before the Gold Rush period. We didn't really have a government structure in this state between 1867 and 1884, when the first Organic Act was completed. And even when it was done, it was an Organic Act quite unlike the traditional Organic Acts for previous territories in the United States, which had normally had mechanisms built in for self-government and easing into local government and having population thresholds to basically kick in self-government and statehood. It was purposefully, for whatever reason, deleted from our first Organic Act, so that we basically had only a few federal officials appointed to oversee an area. And so, again, local government was really a non-issue for perhaps a variety of factors until the gold rushes at the turn of the century in the Yukon and Nome. With those gold rushes, it seems to be the federal government finally knows something maybe should be done. With an increasing non-Native population, well, the premise apparently being somewhat racially motivated, that Native peoples didn't warrant a form of government involvement. And so you had this dual system developed. In 1906, we got an elected non-voting delegate to Congress, and then the second Organic Act in 1912 finally allowed some self-government, but with, again, unusual limitations as compared with other states. We weren't allowed to have counties. And so we had this large area with some smaller enclaves of municipal governments, a territorial government with severe limitations on taxation and certain rulemaking powers in the legislative arena, largely representing only the non-Native portions of the state. And in the meantime, the Native areas were kind of starting to drift into a separate system, so that by the time of the New Deal with the Indian Reorganization Acts in 1934 and 1936, you have establishment of about 70 tribes, maybe 90 depending on how people count them, which were given certain rights, certain government opportunities, and a dual education system had developed under the BIA, and then for the non-natives, another education system. And that kind of just persists until statehood, and you know, we really didn't have a borough system until 63, 64 in this state. And so by the time we were starting to have some sense of a statewide government, we had really two governments, and they didn't mesh. And Harold Ickes tried to establish reservations. He was resisted by Governor Greening and even the Brotherhood of Alaska Native Brotherhood for different reasons. But we don't really have the traditional reservation system outside of Metlakatla. We have tribes. We have federal recognition of certain rights that really aren't falling on any track with the state government. We have an absence of Indian territory under the Venati case, and so we have all kinds of confusing situations where we have some municipal governments in bush areas, some tribal governments, and some state-recognized governments. And ultimately, the solution, I think, is to try to figure out a way to try to make people have a sense that it's really ultimately in everyone's interest to have something like a legislature where everyone's participating from all parts of the state and recognizing it's theirs to have a stake in and it represents their interests. But it's a very sensitive issue for a lot of people because anything that would threaten Native sovereignty claims or ideas of sovereignty is taken to be as something that is threatening to them. And on the flip side of it, having a sense that whole sections of the state might claim that they are a different government entirely off limits to other parts of the state is also seen as threatening. And in the long term, I think that what you ultimately will have, I think, is a change of the population makeup where there'll be more and more in common and less reason for friction. And you know, is there a magic bullet? I don't know what it was, but Bernard DeVoto, in one of his last books that really wasn't published, called The Western Paradox, wrestled with the nature of frontier population compositions. And he made two broad general classifications. He said people that come to frontier areas, and he was talking about the American West, but it could be Alaska, are generally people who are either trying to be adventurers or exploiters, and it was a very general term, or settlers, people who want to make it their home. And so is your life in the is your life on the frontier going to be a passing adventure or a destination? And I don't think he meant to disparage one group or the other, but Alaska certainly had its what you could classify as what he would say the exploited stage, where people came not to make it their home, but to make their fortune and leave. And what he left out was the native peoples of the West, and what would be left out is that they already considered it their home. And as what I think historically will be seen as is more of the development and exploitation stage of Alaska history passes, I think we'll get to the point where more and more people will start to see it as a destination for their families to stay. And I think there's a beginning of a more common ground there that they'll start to recognize that the native peoples of Alaska have always felt that way. And if they start to see like their needs, and we talked about the sexual crimes in bush areas earlier, if people there start to feel that the government that is in place can really address those concerns, because that's one of their concerns, is it's not being addressed, and that they really have everyone's interest in common, that increasingly this as a destination for the majority of the residents will be seen as everyone's problem, everyone's interest in resolving it without having people thinking that the end result has to be a fractured Alaska with tensions that go on unresolved. There's two ways to approach it. You can have a knockdown confrontation with major court cases, leaving someone embittered for a long time, which is a way to get to a destination. Or you can try to look for some middle way that involves discussion and seeing if there's a way that can satisfy this without leaving a very disorganized, almost unworkable patchwork of weird types of different jurisdictions that don't mesh together. That is also not ultimately a very satisfactory solution. But I think it will take time. And frankly, if I'm confirmed and last long enough, I would like to make that the the focus of my interest, because I know the governor would like to make it clear that she feels she is everyone's governor and not just a group of people's governor.
We have time for a couple more questions. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, on the issue of subsistence, what's your opinion of rural preference? Should we be voting on this? What's your take on the subsistence issue?
Well, I think what sometimes is missed by a lot of people is while there's certainly ongoing disputes with the federal government right now as we speak, even most recently on the Kenai Peninsula, that the state has always taken the position that there is a rural preference. It's just the nature and how that's established and what the criteria are that is become kind of clouding the issue, and there are some people who have viewed the state's position as somehow not having that in mind, but that's always been a feature of the state's position on these issues. It's a big deal, and a lot of people have a real interest in this, but I don't think that, you know, we have cases that may ultimately decide a lot of these issues that are, the Manning case has been pending for quite some time. It may shed some light, create some solutions, it may not, but I can't sit here and say I have the magic solution, but I know that there has to be a way to work it out, and it seems to me that one of the things, when I failed to mention, I was on the Alaska Humanities Forum Board, statewide board, Alaska's branch of the National Endowment for the Humanities. I was the chairman, and one of the nicest features of our many programs was what was called the Rose Urban-Rural Exchange, where we actually, through Senator Stevens' support, arranged for rail belt school children to go and live in villages for 2 weeks at a time, and likewise have Native children come and live with an urban family. Not that most of them hadn't been to an urban center, but not actually living with a family. And what was really nice is we filmed a lot of the people afterwards for exit interviews, is it was an eye-opener, and there are an incredibly large number of people in the rail belt who really don't venture beyond the road system, and it's hard, I think, for them to sometimes realize that there are parts of Alaska that life is comparatively quite difficult, and there's, I think, more of an appreciation of why this is such a sensitive issue for Native Alaskans. At the same time, you know, many people come to live in Alaska because it is an opportunity to hunt and fish, and they don't like the idea that somehow enclaves will be created where they're just off limits and what they perceive to be racial reasons. So it's, I'm not sure it's a solution answer to your question, but there's a lot there to work on, and I'd be happy to try to work on it.
Follow-up question on that?
Well, on the rural preference, your statement on the rural preference, that, in fact, is what the courts, or Supreme Court, ruled to be unconstitutional under the state constitution. So I wasn't sure, and I was looking up something here in the book when you made the statement regarding your view on rural preference.
Subsistence preference is what I should have said. I'm sorry if I misspoke there.
Okay, good. Thanks for that clarification. Then, have you had an opportunity to speak with either Mr. Popley or others on certain concerns that the legislature has been tracking for a number of years with regards to tribal status, and if, in fact, you know, there are tribes? And one of the concerns that former Senator Halford had cautioned me to watch out for, that if, in fact, we have areas where people's access to perhaps health care or other services are only offered through a tribal entity, and if that tribal entity is not subject to Alaska's laws, then the citizens, and those being citizens of the state of Alaska, perhaps can only avail themselves of services that are available in the general public through a mechanism by which they potentially have to shed their state constitutional rights at the door in order to get services. And there have been cases where there have been attempts through the cloak of tribalism for entities to separate themselves and say, no, state of laws, Alaska's laws and its protections for citizens don't apply to us. And so I think that's a concern that we need to be mindful of, because we're all citizens of the state of Alaska and should have be assured that our constitutional protections are available to us equally. And I'm wondering if...
Yeah, I did meet with Mr. Popley. He asked to meet with me, and we had a long conversation. And I am aware that it is a very thorny issue and that the state has many ongoing concerns about that type of matter. And where I guess my personal encounter with it most recently has been in I'm part of what's called the Rural Justice Commission, and we have been trying to deal with, in particular, the Indian Child Welfare Act and the jurisdiction of that. And clearly, in the states with reservations, it has an application. Absent reservations, we being the commission, even years before I was on it, has been working on what's basically a memorandum of understanding to try to address how the very issues you're talking about can be addressed. And we don't have a solution for it yet. It is, because of the very things you're talking about, something we're very carefully trying to figure out. Is there a way to do this without jeopardizing things that the state feels and is appropriately concerned about? What happens here if we end up with something that creates financial liability without the ability to regulate?
Senator McGuire, you get the last question.
There are two of them. You can pick which you want first. The first is, you weren't on Law Review, but if you were today and you were writing a comment on the Venati case, what would be your brief summation of whether you agreed with the Supreme Court of the United States or the Ninth Circuit? That's question number one. And question number two, what's the legacy that you would like to leave as Attorney General of the State of Alaska?
The legacy would be that I wouldn't want to be remembered only for my answer to the first part of your question. I think the Venati conclusion that there was no Indian country is appropriate in that you really don't have the same structure as the other states, and to have created Indian country would have then opened up really another box of issues that probably wouldn't have been resolving a lot really quickly, because what would that mean? Where would the boundaries be? And I guess if they had decided otherwise, it would have been somewhat incumbent on them to start to define boundaries and geographical areas. And would that have led to a reservation system or some hybrid of that? I don't know. But, you know, The concern I have about answering that question is that I don't want it to appear that as I try to suggest I would like to try to address these issues and solve them, that I'm not sensitive to the motivations behind that lawsuit in the first place. And the people in those villages, many of them feel very aggrieved for often things that may have happened long before they were around, and there's a lot of reasons for them to feel that way. I had a chance to meet Willie Hensley at the AFN reception a couple of weeks ago, and which is one of the nice perks of at least having this opportunity to sit here. And I had a longer conversation with him than I probably would have if I hadn't been the designee for this job. And he told me the story, which I had read about, when he was a student at UAF and had discovered in his research that, this still belongs to us, meaning Alaska, that it had not been resolved by a war or a treaty, and that was in many ways what set into motion things that led to things like the Alaska Native Land Claims Settlement Act and different issues. And what is clear is, to say that the Venati case was correctly decided, which I think it was, doesn't mean I don't think that
by which
those
court?
Are the Supreme Court. Doesn't mean that there aren't legitimate motivations behind making those challenges and trying to assert claims for their heritage.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kohlberg. We've come to the end of our hearing. What I have now before me is a letter to the Senate President Green in which we would forward your name on to her for consideration by a joint session. Could I get a motion for this letter?
Yeah, move that the letter that you spoke of be moved this time.
Thank you, Senator Huggins. This letter, as we all know in the committee, does not reflect an intent by any of the members to vote for or against the Attorney General designee in any further sessions, but I'll just say you gave a very strong performance here today, and I want to thank you for spending this time with us this afternoon.
Thanks.
And so with that, without any objections, the meeting is adjourned.